Luke chapter 29, we are looking at the good old days. And we like to talk about the good old days, at least most people do anyway. But in Job 29, we see that. We see that Job's perspective in a past chapter was so wise and so good, but this chapter begins to reveal that those words of wisdom that he had had not fully taken over his mind. And it swings back to bemoan his present circumstances and long for the good old days. It shows also how easily, while in pain and suffering especially, we can vacillate and change from one moment or one chapter in life to another, or one chapter of one day to another day, or from morning to afternoon, or from moment to moment for that matter sometimes. But we're just fragile creatures. And that shows us how much we are dependent constantly on God's strength and God's mercy. It's important, and I think it's a good idea, to build precious memories and think back on the precious memories of the past and smile on and thinking about how that God had blessed us in the past and the encouragement that it brings, that He will even bring better things in the eternal future. That's good. However, in the process of counting our blessings, we have to be careful that we don't live in the past and get depressed because things aren't like they were in the past. And that happens. And we can fall into that trap without even hardly realizing it. You know, our thoughts can just run away and all of a sudden it's like, what happened? You know, things were going so good, and all of a sudden, boom, you know, things are not so good. But we can think about, as we get older, think about the times in which our children were gathered around together with us, all together, gathered together there at the table at supper time, and the times in which we would get together on birthdays, and just all the wonderful times we used to have, and how God blessed, and we'd be at the ball game, and we just singing together, rejoicing together, and we can get so caught up in that. That's great. It makes us smile, and we appreciate God's blessings, but we see that as we get older, and we think about those things, and friends and family pass away, children move away, times change, old age creeps in with all its infirmities, and that come with those evil days, as Solomon called them, as he exhorted us to remember our Creator in the days of our youth, before the evil days come. C.H. Spurgeon said something I thought was interesting. He said that too many people write their blessings in the sand, but engrave their sorrows in marble. They want to remember the bad times for some reason. That's what sticks in their minds. They don't count their blessings. They don't think about the blessings. It's always negative. And I think the news does that. Because everything in the news is negative almost. And that just kind of gets you, kind of conditions your mind to think that way. And we shouldn't, as God's children, not that we, again, put our heads in the sand, as I say often, but that we can look at things as they ought to be looked at. We need to focus on enjoying our God now, counting our present blessings, looking for opportunities to serve Him now and ways to worship Him now while we look forward to even better eternal days to come. Now, So what we want to deal with here in this message on the good old days is number one, the fellowship of the good old days. Number two, the fame of the good old days. Number three, the future in the good old days. And fourth and finally, the favor of the good old days. Now, it's different with every one, but anyway, I could identify with some of that in some ways. But let's look first at the fellowship of the good old days. It says there in verse 1 of Job 29, "Moreover, Job continued his parable and said, Oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when God preserved me." Now, first of all, we see a hint there of how long. I've noted that before. Job has been going through this up to chapter 29. It had been several months he had been afflicted here. And but we also see that that Job continued as if he paused for a moment to see if somebody like Zophar, who was really kind of next in line, would say something. But apparently Zophar didn't thought that Job was a hopeless case and didn't say anything, which is, I'm sure he was thankful for, and we are too. But I want to notice something here in that second verse. What is the first thing that Job missed about the good old days? The first thing that came to his mind was his fellowship and communion with God. Now, would that be the first thing we would think about when things are difficult and we're in pain and we're looking back in the past? Is the first thing we would think about is the fellowship and communion with God? Now, I tell you what, that's a tough question, isn't it? Because we're thinking about my physical pain, and that seems like all we can concentrate on. But Job here, being the righteous man that he was, he thought about his communion with God first. That's the thing that pained him the most, is that that wasn't like it used to be. Now, sometimes our idea of the good old days is a mix of two things. One, forgetfulness of the good old days, because we make them out to be better than what they really were. Secondly, there is a lot of creative imagination that's thrown in there about the good old days. In other words, they're not as good as you really thought they were. But when we're in times of sorrow, we tend to exaggerate how bad it is now and how wonderful it was back then. But in Job's case, it really was the good old days. He was being totally honest and accurate in that, what he said. But we do need to treasure God's fellowship that we've had in the past, and treasure it now, so that we may enjoy God's blessings more and more as we even go through difficulties. We may be headed for a lot of difficulty. I was telling Ronnie earlier today that we're in a situation in our country where things could go very bad, very fast. If all of a sudden we can't get gas, can you imagine? You know, we can't. I've been waiting on this guitar speaker thing for 2 months. They said they can't get it anything. Nobody's working. You know, and if there was no gas for whatever reason, they decided to cut it off and make up some flimsy excuse, or whether it was a real excuse, I don't know. But it could go really bad, really fast. So again, I'm thankful for the book of Job in the sense that it prepares us. We might, let's just say that happened. We can't get gas. And we got to start looking for horses to ride and buggies and whatever else. And we would think back, well, the good old days when I used to be able to just go to the gas station and get gas and go wherever. You know, just things like that. When I used to be able to get toilet paper and now I can't. You know, it's just, we have to look at things in the right perspective. And this is what we see in this chapter. Job longed not only for the days before he lost his children and health and wealth and so forth, but again, his sense of being communion, he felt, was close with God, more so than now in these difficulties. But verse 3 says, when his candle shined upon my head, and when by his light I walked through darkness. God, the fellowship that Job had with God brightened his days in the good old days. In their fellowship and communion illuminated his understanding, warmed his heart and soul, guided his feet as a light in his pathway and a lamp unto his feet in the darkness of this world. And he says in verse 4, as I was in the days of my youth, when the secret of God was upon my tabernacle. There was an intimacy that Job enjoyed, not only himself, but his whole household. And the blessings of God flowed upon him and upon his household. And he's talking about the days of his youth. He was older now, and he is looking back. And I thought about Big Joe. Big Joe was, Joe Wilson, was one who preached and enjoyed a measure of popularity, I guess you could say, and then he got treated really wrong at Calvary Baptist in Ashland, Kentucky. And then he was preaching in a church, a small church, in a home. He was in relative obscurity at the end of his days, and I imagine, and this just made me feel sad when I thought about how he used to have it and how he ended up there, dying there in that small little obscure place in Oklahoma. Must have been difficult for him to go through. And sometimes that happens. I think of my father-in-law. You know, the church had to dissolve. And I remember when we were going there and we had the 30-something people that were coming. And it was growing and young people and children and all this. And then they had to dissolve. I mean, it's just a sad thing. And so it's natural to want to sometimes look back to when we were younger. That's natural. And in some ways, that's not so bad when we recognize it was a gift of God in the phase of life that we had to go through. And now we're in our present phase of life that we have to go through by God's hand and His providence. But it's natural to want to be in the prime of life. But it's a dangerous want and desire as well. If we focus so much on the glories of the past that we ignore the opportunities of the future and the present, then we're going to be unprepared to meet the future. We won't be ready for it if we're dwelling on the past. The future is going to come whether we like it or not. We're going to get older whether we like it or not. Unless, you know, God takes us, of course, in death or in the rapture or whatever. But few people will anticipate old age, eagerly anticipate it, and the special problems that it brings. But you cannot avoid it. It's a proven fact that those who have the most birthdays live the longest. And those who live the longest become the oldest. And the old still die. people say things like, old skiers never die, they just go downhill. Or, old bakers never die, they just fail to rise. Or, old golfers never die, they just lose their drive. But we're going to die. I don't care how many cute sayings you might come up with, we're still going to die. Again, unless we're taken in the rapture. But it takes wisdom to know how to grow old, to age gracefully in the challenges of getting older. Job 29:5 says, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were about me. The first thing that Job missed the most was his fellowship with God, and the second thing that he missed the most was his family. Isn't that the way it ought to be? To love our God and our family. Those in that order. But that's what he was missing. Again, we don't see anything about just, you know, he's going to talk a little bit about his health, but that's not the first things he mentions. He doesn't mention, you know, those kinds of things. He mentions the most important things. Verse 6 says, when I washed my steps with butter and the rock poured me out rivers of oil. God had so blessed Job that his communion and fellowship with God, along with his prosperity physically and materially, he could say in every way, my cup runneth over. And he was drenched with God's blessings. Who wouldn't want to have those kinds of days again? When, comparatively speaking, he was on the ash heap and lost his health, wealth, and family. And even some of the things we're going to see here a little bit later. You know, even though Job knew that evil things happen to good people and good things happen to evil people, he knew that. But we naturally like the good things, don't we? We naturally shrink away from anything that's contrary to the flesh. It's called supernatural if we welcome difficulties. That's why Paul could say there in 2 Corinthians in chapter 12, verse 9 and 10, and he saith unto me, God did, my grace is sufficient for thee in regards to the thorn in the flesh he besought the Lord three times about. For my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities and reproaches and necessities and persecutions and distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, that is physically, then am I strong, that is spiritually. That's what should be the most important. But that's what those things are designed. That's what God designs those trials for us, to make us stronger. But little did Job know, God was soon going to demonstrate that he was with him the entire time, watching over him, making sure that Satan did not do anything beyond what God gave him permission to do. God was watching over him. And we can be assured as God's people that the Lord careth for his own. He is with us. He's never going to leave us nor forsake us, the book of Hebrews says. But now let's look at the fame of the good old days. Verse 7. When I went out to the gate through the city, when I prepared my seat in the street. Now, if you recall, the city gates was a very important place. It's where important business transactions were made, kind of like a courthouse or whatever. Judgments and so forth that were people were sentenced or whatever. But it was a city. We don't know which city it was, but it had a gate and, as it were, a public square where Job had a seat. And so it was a rather major urban center. And we see that Job was involved with that. He had his seat there. And that meant he was a predominant city official involved with decisions as a judge would. And likely he was either a mayor or a prominent city council member. And so we see this was the fame that he had of the good old days. Now, I don't know, some of us having some degree of fame, whether it's just in our family or maybe at our high school or whatever kind of school you're in or at the workplace for, you know, your abilities or whatever like that, at church, we could probably think back of the times like that. I mean, I can think of times when I was, you know, in sports and the accolades people would get in sports can make your head swell and it's dangerous. But nonetheless, we can look back at those days and it was something good about that in one sense. Because it pushed you and it caused you to recognize what self-discipline and hard work and so forth can do for you. But notice there in verse 8, the young men saw me and hid themselves. In other words, they stepped aside to make room for Job as he was walking down the street. They moved aside, they hid themselves, and the aged arose. And so we see that the aged even rose up and stood up to honor him as well. This is the kind of prestige that Job enjoyed, and rightly so. That's what you're supposed to do. We've lost that in our culture today. There is... I wasn't too fond about Rodney Dangerfield, but anyway, he had that thing about no respect, nobody get, you know, all this kind of stuff. But and he kind of made a comedy out of it, but really, it's not funny because we have really just gone to where there was no respect for anything and nothing is sacred. But this is what Job was looking back to. Verse 9, the princes refrained from talking and laid their hand upon their mouth. Even the princes stopped talking to see what he would say out of respect toward him. Verse 10, the nobles held their peace. Even those of nobility, they silenced themselves and their tongue cleaved to the roof of their mouth. Whether it's anticipating a word of wisdom or the judgment that would fall from his lips as a high-ranking city official. And then verse 11, when the ear heard me, then it blessed me. And when the eye saw me, it gave witness to me. Not only did Job gain the attention of the people and the leaders of the city in days gone by, but they also liked and appreciated what he had to say. He was blessed and approved by those who heard him. So much different than it was at the present time. They rejected, they mocked and ridiculed him for the things that he said. That's hard to take. Verse 12, because I delivered the poor. It wasn't just what he said, but what he did. But I delivered the poor that cried and the fatherless and him that had none to help. He had a reputation for wisdom and goodness. A man who is full of good works, especially to those who are poor and disadvantaged, those who were fatherless and helpless. Job was not only a man of great wisdom and great wealth and great influence, but he used his wealth and influence to do good instead of being greedy and selfish with his wealth. he, in Job's way of thinking, sins are not just wrong things that people do, and disobeying the known laws of God, but to omit to do good was wrong and sinful. And he's right. They're called sins of commission when, you make an image there. You've committed a sin of, you've committed it. It's a sin of commission. A sin of omission when it says to do good to all men, then we are, when we don't, that's a sin of omission. So he saw it in both sides. What we omit to do or fail to do, and the things that we do that are wrong as well. But now verse 13, the blessing of him that was ready to perish came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. Those are in so much trouble that they're about to die, either due to their starvation, deprivation, persecution, or false accusation. He was there. They came to him because they depended on him. This is a reputation that he had, the fame that he had. But he not only ministered to the fatherless, but he ministered to the widows in their afflictions. And reminds me of James chapter 1, verse 27. Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction and to keep himself spotted from, unspotted from the world. So that he was engaged in pure religion that was undefiled, not just before men, but before God. And of course, to keep himself unspotted from the world was part of it, because we all know of some of these organizations out here that do these things, but they engage in sinful acts, and the heart isn't right. And so it is. Job exercised pure religion, undefiled before God. So Job's friends, who basically were saying, "Well, nothing. You couldn't have done these things, because if you had done these things, these bad things wouldn't have happened to you." And they mentioned that in Job 22, 1 through 11. And of course, he's showing, he waited. I mean, he refrained himself from saying anything until now. But he was thinking about the good old days. And verse 14, I put on righteousness and it clothed me. My judgment was as a robe and a diadem. In other words, Job's life was adorned and crowned with righteousness and just judgment. It set him apart. When someone comes in with a crown and robe and all that, it makes people notice you. But in this way, it was a good thing, because he was like light in a dark world. That's the way he was, the example he set. I was eyes to the blind and feet was I to the lame. I was thinking about Mark Hamby. I was talking to him today, and he can't drive now. You know, he had that seizure, and he fell off the bed, and it was because of the seizure. And he fell off the bed and broke his back and had hurt a bunch of other things, his shoulder and so forth. Well, he can't drive for 6 months now because of that. And he told me that he had a seizure because of the first COVID shot. And then I guess it wasn't quite as bad. But then the second COVID shot is where the seizure was so bad that while he was in bed asleep, he fell off and broke his back. And so now he's trying to recover. He's not all the way right. He can't do what he used to do, and so on. So please pray for him. But, you know, he was in a bad position, and we want to reach out to him if he could ever. I asked him if the church can help you anyway. Just let us know. But I'm sure some of us would be glad to help him out. So anyway, pray for him, but we want to be like that person who may be disabled and be there to help him, just like Job was to these people in verse 15. Verse 16, I was a father to the poor, and the cause which I knew not, I searched out. He was like a father to the poor and who were likely to be taken advantage of. You know, it is hard to think about, but there are people who purposely take advantage of poor people. That's what they do. They take advantage of them and make them slaves and things of that nature. And submit them to harsh servitude toward them. But Job was one who was like a father to them. And he searched out the cases that might be against these poor, brought before the judgment seats to take everything they got or whatever the case might be. He searched it out, and the case of being in unjust courts that would oppress the poor, he protected these who were weak and couldn't fend for themselves in the courts for whatever reason. They didn't have the funds, they didn't have the education or whatever. Job was there to help them out. Verse 17, he went even further. And I break the jaws of the wicked and pluck the spoil out of his teeth. Now, he reminds me of Paul when he said that he was contending with the beasts at Ephesus. He wasn't talking about actual beasts like lions and tigers and bears. He was talking about people. And he's describing the wicked as ferocious beasts, greedy beasts that would try to take everything they got, even their own life. And he rescued them from their clutches and broke their jaws, as it were, in the sense he had not made it to where they couldn't do that to that person anymore. So we see that Job was a good, righteous man, and he had a fame, a reputation for that. And there's a certain sense in which we would want to be liked, but we got to be careful, because if we want to be liked so much, we'll do anything. We'll be a people pleaser instead of a God pleaser. But on the other hand, we can't, I don't care what anybody thinks, and be a jerk. And there's the balance. And I think that's what Job's talking about here. Now, the third point, the future in the good old days. Not of, but in the good old days. This is the way he looked at the future in the good old days. Verse 18, then I said, I shall die in my nest, and I shall multiply my days as the sand. Job figured he was going to continue on. Things were going so well, and he was so prosperous and so enjoyed life so much that, and his health was so good that he would die happy, secure in his nest, in his property and so forth, in his family after a long, good life. A lot of people think that. Sometimes things change for one reason or another. He says, my root was spread out by the waters, and the dew lay all night upon my branch. And this is just a description of the blessing and the abundance that Job was blessed with in his life. And his, you know, he was just like, his roots spread out, he would grow and progress more and more and more. God was blessing him, multiplying his benefits upon him, and as a tree that will not wither. Verse 20, my glory was fresh in me, and my bow was renewed in my hand. Job was confident. He had a vibrant health. Now he didn't. He had a vibrant health and enjoyed it like a tree planted by the rivers of waters, as mentioned in Psalm chapter 1. His bow would be renewed. In other words, the bow is a sign of strength. And he had a strength about him, but also being renewed, when you pull it back with the arrow in there, you're shooting and then it's renewed and so on and so forth. Arrows were symbolic of children. He was in such good health, he expected to have more children, even more children than the 10 that he had back in those days. His future looked bright for him. But then, not only do we see the future of the good old days, but the favor in or of the good old days. Verse 21, like unto me, men gave ear and waited and kept silence at my counsel. Again, his words were respected and esteemed, and he was honored for his wise words. In other words, he gave counsel, and they were quiet about it. They didn't argue with him. They didn't mock him and ridicule him like was happening to him now. I mean, who would like that? We shouldn't want that, obviously. And there's, again, nothing wrong with it to some degree. Verse 22, after my words they spake not again, and my speech dropped upon them. Again, he wasn't being disrespected. There was a silent acknowledgement of the truth and the blessing of his words. Verse 23, and they waited for me as for the rain, and they opened their mouth wide as for the latter rain. They were waiting as somebody was waiting for the rain in the dry and thirsty land to hear what he had to say. Whether it's a judgment or some wise counsel or whatever it was. And he was held in such esteem in verse 24, if I laughed on them, they believed it not, and the light of my countenance they cast not down. In other words, if Job was just joking or saying something facetiously, their eyes and their ears didn't think it was so. They didn't think it was a joke. They just took him seriously for everything that he said and took it as a gospel truth. But his countenance, and the light of my countenance they cast not down. In other words, he had a reputation of being somebody that was winsome, somebody who was encouraging and humbled and blessed others. And so therefore, in that respect, he was a source of stability. He was a rock of security to others. And then finally, verse 25, I chose out of their way and sat chief, and dwelt as a king in the army. In other words, he was chief among the people. He was like a king commanding armies, but notice, as one that comforteth the mourners. He had, he wasn't just a great leader, but he had compassion on people. Sometimes leaders are hard and they get the job done. I think it was, I forgot which war it was. Maybe please remember commander in the army, or maybe his Marines. His name was Vinegar Joe. I don't know if you ever heard of him, but anyway, he was hard as nails and so forth. But the soldiers didn't like him too much, but he did get the job done. And it's one thing to be a commander-in-chief that way, and it's another thing to be one that would have compassion on the others at the same time who were having difficulty. Well, during the reign of, you think of Job, he was kind of like Barnabas in the New Testament, wasn't he? What does Barnabas's name mean? Encourager. Job was an encourager. But when King David was young, they had a new king. There was a judge before him called Samuel. In the days of Samuel, the prophet, those were the good old days. And now we come to King Saul. And I just want you to notice how David responded to that scenario. He lived at his house there under his father's roof, enjoying good times back in the days of Samuel the prophet. And now we had King Saul. And the Philistines were feared, and the Israelites lived under the bondage of that fear. I want to notice there, as we look at 1 Samuel chapter 17, that David, he went and to see his brothers. His dad had commanded him to go down and give him some food. And then we see that they talked to him about Goliath and this great, you know, warrior and so forth. And then we find there in verse 24 that when the Goliath came out there and challenged him in verse 24, and all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man that has come up? Surely to defy Israel is he come up. And it shall be that the man who killeth him, the king shall will enrich him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." And David spake to the man that stood by him, saying, "What shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine and taketh away the reproach from Israel?" Now, he wasn't looking at the difficulties, just constantly looking at the difficulties. Because he had the eye of faith, he could look positively in the future. He says, "For who is this uncircumcised Philistine, that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered after the same manner, saying, "So shall it be done to the man that killed them." Of course, we find that Eliab, the oldest brother, was, you know, jealous and upset that he came over there and falsely accused him of a lot of things. But then we find in verse 31, "And when the words were heard which David spake, they rehearsed them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, 'Let no man's heart fail because of him. Thy servant will go and fight with this Philistine.' And Saul said to David, 'Thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth.' And David said to Saul, 'Thy servant kept his father's sheep.'" He's looking in the past. "Kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock, and I went after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and smote him and slew him. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine presently shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. David said, 'Moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion, out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine.' And Saul said unto David, 'Go, and the Lord be with thee.'" David wasn't just looking back at the peaceful times of the good old days in the past. He didn't just look at that and stop there. That's what we do sometimes. We look at the good old days and we stop there. And that will bring us to depression if we dwell there too long. All too often, we stay there in the good old days. We live in the past. The good old days and the blessings of the good old days are not to be an anchor to hold us back, but it's to be a rudder to guide us forward, to propel us forward and to guide us in the right direction. Seeing God's promises and blessings for our good in the past, we are encouraged to step forward to be able to gain more precious memories of what God is going to do. The more precious memories we have in the past, the more encouragement we ought to have to progress in the future. Because of the encouragement, looking there with faith like David did. If we could duplicate the good old days today, we would be robbed of spiritual maturity. And really, that's what should be the most important thing to us. So may God help us to look forward and not so much in the past, but look forward in the hope that is set before us and the great and new eternal days ahead, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith.